Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and we are still running in a trimmed down format this week. Sorry about that. Regular listeners would know that we've been dealing with some unexpected stuff over here in the house of business. But the good news is things have settled down. We're back at our house after more than 3 weeks away, and things are looking good for a return to the full format show either next week or the week after. And thanks to everyone for being so understanding on that. Last week was a reasonably slow news week, but there's a lot of good stuff to get through this week. Adam Boileau is on break at the moment, so in this week's news segment, we'll be chatting with his colleague at Insomnia Security, Mark Pipes Piper. And this week's show is brought to you by Cylance, C-Y-L-A-N-C-E, the anti-malware company. Jim Walter of Cylance will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about a couple of things. We'll be looking at fileless malware. And for what it's worth, that is a term that we both hate. And we'll also be talking about how complete amateurs are now able to run reasonably sophisticated malware campaigns these days, thanks to the badware for hire business getting just slicker and slicker. That is coming up later. But first up, let's get into the news with Mark Piper. And Pipes, last week, Adam and I sort of talked about the trouble brewing between the Russian government and the app maker Telegram. And that seems to have boiled over in the last couple of days.
Yeah, basically in the last 24 hours, it's gotten really interesting. The long short of it is the Russian Federal Service for Supervision of Communications, Information Technology and Mass Media failed at their attempt to get the encryption keys out of Telegram. So they've now gone ahead and started implementing blocking of Telegram traffic with inside Russia. And because of the way that domain fronting is leveraged from Telegram, and we saw that be implemented after the restrictions came in Iran sort of late last year, early this year, they do domain fronting off the likes of Amazon and Google. So at the moment, we're looking anywhere up to sort of 15 million addresses across various providers, cloud providers being blocked. And that's obviously causing quite a bit of disruption inside of Russia right now.
Yeah, now this is an interesting thing, right? Because as you pointed out, like they use domain fronting and that gets complicated, right? Trying to block that. And that's used by organizations like Tor to great advantage. And I can only guess that Russia is basically trying to put some pressure on Amazon and Google to boot Telegram off its servers. But all I can say about that is good luck, because it ain't going to work.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach, right? We're not going to be able to win in the court of law necessarily on the encryption keys. But what we can do is say, hey, we'll block the traffic and we're just going to go ahead and enforce that, no matter what the cost. I'd hate to imagine what the pressure is on the Telegram developers at the moment. I mean, we know that they're used a lot by journalists and individuals that oppose the Russian government, but I don't know how much of that sentiment sort of flows down to when I can't shop for shoes on various services.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've seen the political blowback over apps being blocked, like in Brazil when WhatsApp would occasionally go down. I mean, everybody in Brazil uses WhatsApp, and it really pisses people off when this sort of critical application is made unavailable, let alone blocking, you know, half the bloody internet. And as you pointed out, yeah, 15 up to, I didn't know it was that high, but 15 million IP addresses belonging to those cloud providers are now just, you know, going into the void if you're Russian.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it seems to have said within the Ars Technica article that we read that it's being blocked at an ISP level. So it seems to be that the Russian way of doing it, rather than the Great Firewall way of doing it, was to send service orders to ISPs of just, here's the IPs to block, and just kept ramping up the number over the last 24 hours to them.
Yeah, and I think if I recall correctly, I read something about how they didn't actually require a court order from the Russian courts because they're dressing this up as an anti-terrorism measure, which is a familiar thing. We've heard this sort of thing before. Now, look, staying with news about Russia, the US and the UK have put out an alert, I guess you'd call it, talking about Russian activity taking over all manner of routers, everything from, you know, customer premise equipment to small business stuff to enterprise stuff. And they're making a big deal out of this. And it's really hard to gauge whether or not this is a serious thing by reading the reports, because we've seen some really breathless coverage in the mainstream media about this being some global cyber attack. But to me, it does look concerning, but it more looks like what they're doing is getting ready for something. Do you know what I mean? They're putting a foothold in an awful lot of stuff out there and just sort of letting it be known that they have a pretty decent footprint of compromised devices about the place. Is that your take as well?
I'm really not sure what to make of it. I think the timing's interesting, and like they've made a really big deal about the symbolic sort of stand together nature between the UK and the US in this advisory. And so I'm not entirely convinced that this isn't more sort of just a show of solidarity amongst each other with regards to the larger political landscape against Russia at the moment, with the likes of the nerve agent attack that was on UK soil.
That's the thing. I mean, it does smell a little bit like politics to me as well. But then, you know, a couple of times I've seen advisories like this pop out and thought, oh, it's politics. And then, you know, later on you get some details about the scope of it and you're like, oh, okay, right, they were really going for it. So, I mean, that's got to be a possibility.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things we know is while a lot of the routers out there may not necessarily seem high value in targeting individuals or targeting individual organizations, they can be really useful just to originate from the right geographic location if you're conducting other attacks, right?
Yeah.
So if you're an SOC analyst, for example, looking at VPN origins into your environment, if you're in the UK and you see someone on an ADSL connection in the UK logging in over VPN, it's probably not going to be flagged immediately as this is a suspicious connection, right?
Yeah, it feels to me, though, it might be more – the tone strikes me that they're more worried about sort of an attack in volume, like if things really jump off. But it is – yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. Rather than just using home routers as jump points, I don't think that's worth an alert. But yeah, who knows? There's not enough detail here to really know, but hopefully in time it will become clear. Now, Motherboard has been laying into the FBI. Some would say that's justified. Talking about their you know, highly questionable narrative around going dark. And they're saying this because the FBI has apparently bought this technology called Gray Key, which can unlock all manner of phones, iPhones, whatever. So, you know, the tone of these pieces is sort of saying, well, see, you know, the FBI doesn't actually have a going dark problem. You know, they're complaining about nothing. Here's a device they can buy to unlock all of these devices. I got to say, I'm not quite sold on that narrative, but I want to get your thoughts before I give you mine.
Yeah, look, I've read through the couple of pieces. There was some out of Motherboard, and I think the other one I read was out of Forbes, effectively saying that, yes, the going dark problem probably isn't as tight as what the FBI states at the moment. Here's a device that's available for $15,000 or whatever that you plug it in and can crack right the way up through to iOS 11 on modern hardware. The problem I have with it is they keep referencing the San Bernardino case as saying, look, the FBI made a great deal during the San Bernardino case that we're going through saying we can't unlock the phone. And there seems to be some confusion as to whether or not they had this capability or similar capability on the shelf for that case and whether or not they leveraged the case as to make an example effectively is one of the assertions that's being made. And honestly, not too sure. We know Gray Key is a relatively new development that's been put out there. We know Cellebrite sort of charged a high rate and brought some supposedly new technique to the game to be able to pop the San Bernardino case. So it's, again, pretty hard to say. I mean, one thing is clear is the FBI aren't being straight up with lawmakers. I think that's probably adding a lot of confusion to this for those trying to decipher what's going on.
Yeah, well, there's letters flying back and forth. I think some congressional representatives have written to the FBI saying, you know, WTF. But look, I have a perspective on this. Yeah, I'm not even going to say whether I agree or not. I'm just going to try to explain what I feel is the FBI's position here. First of all, they're a very big organization with lots of different units that focus on lots of different stuff. And just because one unit has a capability doesn't mean it's available, you know, agency-wide. But what I think the FBI's position is, and just generally law enforcement globally, is, hey, when we ask AT&T for a phone tap, we are not required to hack into the network to do that. Okay, whereas when we want access to a device, we are required to bypass security controls to get access under a warrant, right? So I think that's... You know, that's why, to me, a lot of this coverage kind of seems off base. It's kind of beside the point. Okay, they can unlock a whole bunch of phones now, but they're not guaranteed that access in the future when they might need it for very good reasons. So I just sort of feel like this is a bit of a red herring. Do you sort of see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, and that did cross my mind reading through this, is how much of this is them positioning for future proofing against, yeah, like what we know the way technology is going.
And I think it would be an incorrect assumption to say that they've had this capability all along. I mean, it's great for them that some smart people have figured out how to unlock all of these devices, but that doesn't mean they could do that 3-6 months ago.
Yeah, but it's not even guaranteed to work next month after the next round of patches, right?
That's it.
It's like it's also part of the problem. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's one of these ones that isn't going away soon. I think we've been discussing this for at least 5 years, maybe longer. So it's interesting, though, no matter how many times we worry about, like, you know, well, we get told that they're worried about criminals going dark, so to speak, as they always seem to somehow end up with a magic box that they plug into and get the result.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know, though. It is that arms race, right? And for the first time, it feels like people on the defensive side, you know, can actually win this one. So I think that's why the, you know, various law enforcement agencies are pretty nervous. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, you've got to make your own judgment as to whether or not that nervousness is justified. Rob Joyce, former head of TAO at NSA, turned White House security advisor, is on the out. And this is because, well, this comes hot on the heels of Tom Bossert resigning as the White House Homeland Security advisor. So that was, I believe that was Rob Joyce's boss. So he's out now. And apparently the new cybersecurity advisor will be appointed by John Bolton, who has expressed some rather, shall we say, interesting views on the cybers. So all I can say is please don't be Rudy. Please don't be Rudy. Please don't be Rudy.
Yeah, look, I read this on Twitter last night and this morning, and I thought it was actually quite a blow to that level where decisions get made. I mean, one of the things that Rob is – I personally believe it's been incredible. He knows what's happening on the ground. He understands at a technical level what's going on out there in the field. And to be able to translate that up to the highest level of policy and governance, I think is actually quite a really tough task. And he seems to have done really well of it.
I remember one time Adam and I, this was last year sometime, there was some policy coming down the line and we were like, oh, it's going to be stupid. It's going to be terrible. And then when the policy document landed, we're like, hey, this looks actually pretty good. And it had, you know, Rob Joyce's fingerprints all over it. And he's totally happy to have a Barney on Twitter and get involved and actually answer questions. And, you know, I was just commenting a few weeks ago about how I thought that was fantastic. And I just hope we don't wind up with some dunce who just wants to pad out his resume or her resume.
If I was in America right now, I'd want to stay optimistic, but, you know, Rudy.
Yeah. Now, look, speaking of Rob, he has weighed into something. Adam and I discussed it last week, but I actually left it on the cutting floor because I wanted to wait for more people to weigh in. Brian Krebs has been going apoplectic lately, talking about how the GDPR is going to result in the Whois database basically being removed from public use. And of course, the Whois database is very, very useful to malware researchers and threat hunters and all manner of people. So, you know, Brian has been saying, look, this is going to be a disaster. It's going to really slow down a lot of investigations. And he was really the only one that I could see who was really making a big deal out of it. But Rob Joyce himself just weighed in on Twitter, quote tweeting Brian and saying the GDPR is indeed going to undercut, and I'll read from his tweet, undercut a key tool for identifying malicious domains on the internet. Whois database will be non-compliant or have to purge that data that makes it useful to find bad actors. Brian Krebs is spot on. Cyber criminals are celebrating GDPR. Now, that last line, I think, you know, might be overcooking it a little bit, but this looks like it's going to be a serious problem.
Yeah, and it seems to be, looking through the Twitter thread on this, like a lot of people have missed the point, right?
Because people don't put their real names in the Whois, and it's, yeah, you're right, it's not the point.
And I think people completely underestimate the amount of attribution or being able to detect, say, up-and-coming phishing domains based on, we know that fake email that's used by this actor is used all over the place. So we don't actually need to know their legitimate details. What we need to know is the shared details they put into their registration. So, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, like, the Whois system and Whois privacy for the general netizens out there has actually been quite a mess, depending on which jurisdiction you're in. But on the other hand, obviously, it's useful when you're doing analysis on malicious domains and that are being used for malicious purposes. So what would be interesting to see is, you know, what the provisions in GDPR are for coming up with exemptions and whether or not they decide that the Whois is part of that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that discussion's been had yet, at least not that I've seen within the EU.
I wonder if there's something they could do to, like, semi-anonymize the data. Like, if you had hashed, you know, like strongly hashed identifiers from Whois fields, you know, surely that gives you what you need, right? You don't need to know the actual email address necessarily. Oh, I guess sometimes you do, right? I'm just trying to think of ideas here.
And this has been advocated in the past just for general privacy means, right? Like nothing to do with actual malicious use on stuff, but just for general sort of like, you know, how can we assert ownership on a domain without having to put all that private info out there? So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens over time, right? Like I think Krebs and Joyce are both right in one respect, but I also think there's a balance to the millions of domains and people's identifiable information out there that aren't doing bad stuff with it.
Yeah, that's true. And it's crazy, like, the level of private information that you're supposed to provide for a domain. And if that information is bogus, they can yank your domain, right? So it's probably something that is overdue to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Talk about a glass half full view. There we go. Now, look, you know, hot on the heels of Facebook fronting up to hearings, Senate hearings in the United States, they've apparently just dropped a bunch of like cybercrime Facebook groups that had 300,000 members. And, you know, every time you read about Facebook dropping some nasty group, you sort of wonder why it took them so long. And I don't think this is any different.
Yeah, look, this is hilarious and classic Krebs. Krebs got bored and spent a couple of hours on Facebook and identified up a bunch of cybercrime groups, made a little bit of a pointing out of it, I think, on his blog. I can't quite remember. And then all of a sudden Facebook is like, oh, yeah, we can drop all of those.
Brian Krebs winning, making friends all over the place.
My suspicion is they were already tracking them, right? Maybe they were gleaning intelligence out of them. Maybe they were passing it back to other authorities. Maybe it was just left in place to see who was using
these services. Or maybe they were asleep at the wheel because, like, if you look at some of the stuff that's happened with Facebook lately, maybe, you just think, geez.
I know when I did my search transparency look around last year and having a look at, you know, who's registering PayPal domains and doing PayPal phishing is like, you know, you see a bunch of kids in Morocco driving around a Mercedes and making money and putting it all on their Facebook and selling their stuff on their Facebook. So I don't know. I mean, I just found it hilarious that, you know, whenever creeps get bored, something hilarious happens. Like, it's great.
Some interesting news from Intel. They're going to allow antivirus engines to use integrated GPUs for scanning, which is, I kind of wonder, what is there a need for this? Does this make sense? Like, I'm guessing there's a reason for it because they've announced it, but tell me.
The reason is CPU cost, right? Like, when you're scanning file systems and going through a large number of files, it's very CPU intensive. And one of the greatest criticisms AV has always had is the performance impact, like the way that it can cause instability on a system. And that's usually, like I'd say, 95% of the time CPU related. So what Intel is saying is like, fine, do it on the GPU. It'd be interesting to see how it goes. I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, it'll be implemented great the first time. But obviously having more processing space where they can offload stuff to hardware away from the CPU may result in some benefits. What I actually found interesting was part of this announcement is they announced their Intel Advanced Platform Telemetry, which is basically a tool that allows them to combine machine learning with threat intel somehow. So it seems to be that Intel's now going to be able to say, okay, well, let's do the telemetry off the hardware to send back for threat analysis. And Cisco's the first that are up on this, going to be doing it on their new Tetration platform, I think it was, which is used for sort of data center layer processing, network routing. So,
because we know when Intel does stuff around data centers and management, it always works out really well.
Yeah, but I mean, what I found is like really interesting is the trend, I guess, at the moment to go offload as much as possible on various hardware side, right? Like, don't trust the software layer at all. Because I think they also announced that they're doing some more stuff around secure boot and telemetry around, like, you know, I guess, hesitation of the device, whether or not it's trustworthy at the time that it's doing the computing or something. So,
you mean they're doing all of the stuff that they were going to do when they bought McAfee that they never did? That's amazing that they do it after they offload McAfee, right?
But I must admit, I commented to myself that, like, wow, like, you know, they finally got there.
Yeah.
It only took about 7 years or something. But it's a trend we're going towards, and it'll be interesting to see if there is actually any benefit to this stuff. I think it's too early to tell, personally, but we'll see.
Chinese mobile device maker ZTE in all sorts of trouble. They have been banned from buying US goods, and the NCSC has also, in the UK, has also put out an alert saying don't use their equipment.
Yeah, this is a case I had my head in the sand about. I had no idea what was going on, which is In 2017, ZTE settled $1.19 billion for violation of sanctions, where basically they were selling devices to Iran and North Korea. As part of the settlement of around that $1.9 billion is, you know, effectively 7 years of sanctions on US goods and being able to buy US supply chains. Now, what isn't mentioned here, and one thing I'm curious about, is whether or not this includes software, right? Because I think ZTE make Android devices, and whether or not it includes the licensing for various Android components, whether or not they're allowed to still chain those in.
But it just seems like they're copping it from all angles at the moment, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other interesting thing about this was effectively where they also got caught, you know, trying to hide their sanction violations even after they'd been busted doing sanction violations.
Oh, yeah, and they promised to fire a bunch of people, and then the US government found out they'd been they'd been giving them, you know, full bonuses and stuff and backslaps and high fives for selling to Iran. Yeah. And that did not go down well.
Yeah, and then I guess, as you previously mentioned, there's a little footnote in this article where they're like, National Cybersecurity Center in the UK said just don't ZTE.
Yeah, don't. And an interesting quote from the technical director of NCSC said, NCSC assessed that the national security risks arising from the use of ZTE equipment or services within the context of the existing UK telecommunications infrastructure cannot be mitigated, which is a hell of a thing to read from like an NCSC report, right? Like that's... Oh, okay. We're kind of screwed on that one. Because, of course, you know, they don't just make phones. They make telco equipment. And they're saying, yeah, oh, we've installed this stuff already. It's a risk and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think they're not alone in that position. So,
yeah. The FTC in the United States made an interesting decision, which will be a joy to hackers everywhere.
Yeah, apparently the warranty void if sale is broken stickers are meaningless, effectively now when it comes through to it. So it used to be that it was seen as if you broke the seal, then you'd be voiding the warranty, and the FTC has come back and said, no, that's not the case. People are allowed to look inside their devices. And this relates to a larger sort of trend, I guess, going on in the States at the moment. If you follow tech news, is there's been a huge right to repair movement going on, especially around Apple devices and various other devices, to say we should have the right to repair our own devices and we shouldn't have to go through any licensing or any sort of bureaucracy to be able to do so. So it's a ruling from the FTC that will probably be seen as the right one by many.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. I mean, there was all of the brouhaha over the John Deere farming equipment where people were actually modifying their software and, you know, getting in all sorts of trouble with John Deere over that. And then, you know, we saw some years ago, I think it was either Volvo or BMW, that basically cryptographically locked other, you know, normal scan tools out of their cars, and then they were taken to court and forced to reverse that. So, you know, this is an ongoing thing, and it's nice to see a powerful, a large regulator from the largest market in the world actually taking that sort of stance. Now, here's one a listener sent me a while ago, and I just sort of missed it, but I sort of found it on a dusty tab. The advertising standards body in the United Kingdom has issued a ruling on complaints made against Barclays Bank over their advertising. And now, this might sound like something that doesn't belong in a security podcast, but it absolutely does. Mark, tell us about this.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, effectively, Barclay ran a series of ads that said, you know, make sure you look for the padlock. That padlock means that your transactions will be secure. And the argument is, it's like, no, actually, the padlock does not guarantee that your transaction will be secure. And effectively said that it was, you know, false assertion being made as part of their advertising. And the advertising authority upheld the complaint. So basically to say that a padlock in the URL bar does not mean that the transaction will necessarily be secure. So one thing I'm grateful for is I did not have to sit through the hearings on this one.
Yes. Well said. NIST has released its updated cybersecurity framework.
Yeah, 1.1 of the cybersecurity framework is out. There's a few changes in there. The number one that I spotted that I'm quite pleased to see is managing supply chain security. So as we've seen in the last sort of 12 to 24 months, supply chain attacks are up. They're being used by not just nation states. And so one of the things that we've been concerned about for some time and we've been talking to a few people about for some time is actually the overall supply chain security of your infrastructure. And this update addresses that. So that's really good.
Yeah, and there's a bunch more stuff on authentication, identity, and stuff. And yeah, I mean, these changes were flagged a while ago, but that's they've now dropped. Oh, Baylen Siba has been in the news. He's been messing around with emergency alert sirens. Yeah, they didn't hold up too well in the face of Baylen's, you know, genius.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, it's this classic situation where radio packets weren't encrypted, but figured out how to sort of the protocol that's used for those packets, and went ahead and played Rick Astley's Never Going to Give You Up on a siren.
There you go. Baylen, you know, I mean, this isn't the most elaborate hack, but Baylen, I'm sure you know him as well, Mark. He's a very, very sharp dude.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the great things about this was the response was like, well, you know, if anyone else was looking at this, it would be quite hard for them to figure out what the unencrypted packet structure is. And I'm not entirely convinced on that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a few weeks ago, we spoke on the show about the so-called Drupalgeddon bug. This is Drupalgeddon 2, because apparently the first Drupalgeddon was last year. But yeah, real nasty RCE in Drupal. I was expecting this to be immediately weaponized and burn down half the internet. It took a little bit of time, but it seems like this one's doing the rounds now, and it's pretty ugly.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely lots and lots of scans going on for the Drupal vulnerability. What's interesting about this one from my perspective is, I guess, sort of two things. One is the patch was quite smart on the fact that it mitigated the vulnerability, but unless you had good knowledge of Drupal internals, it took a little while to figure out what exactly they were mitigating, right? So the patch did a little bit of, not obfuscation, but just
they sort of sidestepped it. They made the bug dead without fixing it, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. The other thing is that it, from the blog posts that have come out over the last sort of 2 or 3 days, it's clear that lots of people had figured it out, but no one wanted to be the first to publish it. So it was only after Sans published that the fact that they're seeing active scanning for a proof of concept in a while, then all of a sudden we saw a whole bunch of GitHub drops and blog posts around, well, here it is for this version of 8, here it is for this version of 7. So it seems to be a lot of people actually held back publishing their analysis of the vulnerability until it had been seen in the wild. So I found that pretty interesting because
it's a high impact thing, right? So you don't want to be like, oh, look, this is pretty interesting. Here's how it works. And then, you know, everything burns down and you're like, oh, oops.
Yeah, exactly. So, yep, it's out there. I think after the initial post, I think GoDaddy was saying they saw at least 150 IPs simultaneously hitting their address space trying to pop it. So if you have Drupal out there, there's a good chance it's already gone. So good luck on that.
I am reminded, Pipes, of when I launched the Risky Biz was on Drupal for a while, for some years. I think we launched that around episode 100. This was a customized Drupal build that I asked you to have a poke at. And you found two bugs. You found a bug in the banner ad code we were using, which was Hilarabad, but you also found a bug in Drupal core. Well done to you. I just wanted to remind you of that.
It's going back a few years, sure.
It is going back a few years. Yubico is now supporting FIDO 2. That is interesting, especially for, you know, Win10 and Microsoft Azure Active Directory users.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting about this is, you know, they've implemented their own client authenticator protocol that they've developed. They've taken it to market, Windows and Azure Cloud Services obviously being the first ones, but it's being really marketed and pushed as passwordless login, which I've got to admit, I haven't had a great deal of interest to look into yet, but it seems to be that we're finally hitting the bit in the future where with the likes of WebAuthn and various other protocols, we're ending up in a position where this may actually be achievable, that we can, you know, everyone wants to get rid of passwords. Like, it's the root cause on so many issues, and maybe now we're getting there where we have the hardware tokens and the protocols in place that it may be achievable. So it'd be really interesting to see what people do with this and the likes of WebAuthn in the coming months.
Yep, indeed. Well, Mark, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for filling in for Adam. It's always great having you on the show, and we'll chat to you again later this year, I'm sure.
My pleasure, Pat.
That was Mark Piper. His friends call him Pipes, with a look at the week's news. Big thanks to him for filling in for Adam this week. He always does a sensational job. And I did notice too that there's a story kicking around. I just noticed it kicking around as I was preparing this week's show about some Canadian kid who's been arrested for downloading Freedom of Information documents in Canada via a direct object reference. And it sounds like a pretty insane thing to charge someone over. So yeah, we'll be talking about that one next week. Okay, we have two announcements this week. First up, Duo Security is hiring. And by the looks of things, it is a killer gig for someone who wants to move up in their career. It's a senior R&D manager role. They are looking for someone who loves R&D and who has experience managing teams of creative technologists. The new hire will be reporting directly to Rich Smith, the director of Duo Labs. And they're looking for candidates in Ann Arbor, Michigan or Austin, Texas. Haroon Mia joked on Twitter, actually, that people would actually pay to work for Rich. So there you go. That's a pretty ringing endorsement. Rich is at RSA this week, the poor man. But he says he's available to meet with potential candidates while he's there. You can drop me an email to broker an introduction, patrick@risky.biz. And I've linked through to a full job description in this week's show notes if you would like to apply directly for that position with Duo. Also, if you are at RSA, another one of our sponsors, Remediant, is having a party there. Remediant just released a new version of its software. That software is called Secure One, and it's designed to make it easy to use corporate domain creds to authenticate to Linux boxes. And it's agentless, which is nice. And I certainly know a few people out there have had all sorts of drama wrestling with auth agents designed to do this sort of thing on Linux. And yes, it is agentless. Remediant's whole thing is managing privileged access, just-in-time administration, that sort of thing. But yes, they are having a party in San Francisco during RSA week, where they'll be talking about the work they did with Lockheed Martin. Go to remediant.com to find out more or check the show notes if you want to RSVP to their party. Remediant.com/RSA is the party URL. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Cylance, the AV company. Cylance was the first company to come along and really challenge the incumbent AV providers, and the way they did that was by building a machine learning-based malware classification engine and doing that before it was cool. They're like machine learning hipsters. They were into it before you were. Now, their malware classifier worked so well, the company is now worth $1 gajillion. And you can kind of blame Cylance for everyone hyping machine learning so much. And it's because they want to be worth $1 gajillion as well. Now, Jim Walter is a senior member of Cylance's so-called SPEAR team, focusing on next-level attacks, actors, and campaigns, as well as underground markets and associated criminal activity. Jim joined Cylance following 17 years at McAfee Intel Security, running their advanced threat research and threat intelligence teams. And I thought I'd ask him some basic questions, really, about what's happening out there in the areas that he covers. And he said two things have caught his interest lately. First, the trend towards so-called fileless malware, which, isn't actually fileless, and also the number of, real amateurs who are now running malware campaigns, basically because malware developers and distributors alike are happy to rent out their tools and services to whoever wants them, and they've made that process a lot easier. It's like turnkey malware campaigns. So Jim had some thoughts on that as well. Anyway, here is Jim Walter kicking off the conversation with his thoughts on the ridiculously named fileless malware.
Obviously, we're still seeing a lot more, and this isn't necessarily a new this year trend, but it's kind of become one of those ever-increasing things, right? So we're still seeing a lot more attacks where, the first, stage or two are based on, some people call them fileless. I kind of disagree with that definition, but they're based on, delivering, the first stage via a malicious document that then runs usually a few layers of obfuscated steps in order to get to the payload that you're trying to get to. So it's hard to see that first stage or that first malicious quote unquote document is a bad thing if all that it looks like to a traditional scanner or traditional control is just a bunch of encoded script. You can't tell that it's bad. Or if it's just a script that goes and downloads something, it doesn't necessarily know that that's a bad thing. But what people are doing is putting layers upon layers upon layers of scripting behind some of these initial stage attacks in order to better attempt to evade some of the controls that are in place. Through that path, the email server, the NIPS to the email server, the AV scanning on both the email server and the endpoint, et cetera, all the way down so that, nothing actually becomes a detectable payload until several steps later after all these different PowerShell, JavaScript, VBs, et cetera, have run. And then you get your final thing. More recently, we're seeing that used more and more, which has been the case for a while, but it's getting to a point where we're seeing just more and more layers. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on.
I'm guessing they just call it like fileless because it doesn't actually drop its payload to disk, right? But that, it's always struck me as strange terminology as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's where some people get that name. Okay, it's not fileless because it's not a PE file. It's not an executable or a DLL that is initially dropped out of that email or downloaded from that site. But there are files involved. You know, you are dropping a script or a batch file or a piece of VB code to the disk. It gets run as a file on the file system. So there are files involved in what a lot of people call fileless attacks. When I think of the term fileless attacks, I think of Code Red, Slammer.
Yeah, like a single UDP packet that causes the internet to burn down. That's pretty cool.
What you said, SQL Slammer was a fileless attack. Yeah. Having a macro, a Word document with a bunch of macros that drop a bunch of scripts that then eventually down the road end up with a executable that has been downloaded.
That's not fileless. I'm with you. Exactly. I'm with you. That's why I don't actually use that term on the show. How successful are these malware authors, though, with these approaches in terms of using script-based and command-based stuff to evade AV? Because I'd imagine, too, like most AV tooling has really not been set up to look for dodgy commands. It's not been set up to look for dodgy scripts unless they're a very specific script. Like, you'd really need to be mixing up your detection a little bit to catch that sort of stuff.
Well, what you have to be able to do is sort of evolve to be able to consider the context of the activity that's occurring. So you really have to start kind of behaving in a, or you have to start paying attention to behavior and context of what's happening within that interaction, right? So, if you take a very simple example, and this has been was a problem, 10, 15 years ago, when is PSExec evil, right? So it's a legitimate tool. It's used often for very good, normal stuff. At the same time, it's bundled a lot with bad stuff and used in bad ways. So when is that evil? Well, sometimes it's easy. Sometimes the malware author who's relying on the use of that tool will drop their own copy of it. And that drop copy will be repacked or altered in such a way that makes it easy.
That's an easy way to do it. But I mean, if they're somehow managing to access native PowerShell, that's a bit more difficult.
Exactly. That's when you have to start looking at the context. So, is this anomalous for what normally happens on this machine? So that's strike one. B, what process is calling this? And is that what I would consider abnormal or anomalous or outside of what I know to be a normal, safe interaction with that file? So there's all kind of ways that you can approach looking at it from a contextual point of view,
how effective is that though? Right. Because, it's almost like we're having to go back and look at, a whole different class of heuristics that are very varied, right? Like the way that people and tools in particularly enterprise tools use PowerShell, that's difficult to know when something's weird because there's so much crackheaded enterprise software out there that does crazy stuff that you have to let happen. So how do you go about modeling what's normal and what's not when it comes to, that sort of behavior?
Well, in a lot of environments, it comes down to, you almost have to kind of tune it. So, you can deploy some sort of fancy technology, endpoint control that is able to deal with script activity and prevent. But this could take some work to get it tuned to your environment or that host's behavior. So you don't really necessarily want to take and everything is blacklisted approach because, as you said, there are some legitimate times when certain things need to run a PowerShell command or run a script in a certain way or from a certain place or run PowerShell to communicate to a certain remote machine and download stuff. And none of that is necessarily evil, but if you can look at it in the context of, is this anomalous or is this something that I have via policy determined that this machine shouldn't be able to do, then that's what we need to take action. So a lot of the most successful approaches do allow for the capability, on some level of sort of tuning it. So it's sort of analogous to when, the early days, although it's moved along since then, but sort of analogous to the early days of a network intrusion prevention where people would have to spend weeks at a time, just listening and monitoring. So, okay, this is normal. This is not normal. This is my baseline. So, it works best if you kind of understand the baseline and believe it or not.
So hang on, is Silence focusing on that or are you more focusing on grabbing additional payloads as they come down? Or are you detecting malicious activity on scripting activity?
Absolutely. Yeah. All of the above, because, you know, our goal is prevention, period. Right. So if prevention means don't allow that script to run, then we need to understand how is that script running? Who called that script? Why did they call it? Where did they call it from? And what is it trying to do? You know, we take in, you know, simple attributes like that amongst others, and we can make a determination pre-execution on whether or not it should be allowed to do what it's doing.
I'd imagine you would have collected some pretty decent telemetry by now, being a sort of cloud platform, so you'd be able to whitelist a lot of the enterprise stuff.
Like anybody else in the industry, that is part of it. So, not everyone kind of understands that about the quote AV industry is, of course we spend a lot of our time looking at the bad stuff, but we also have to be safe, and we spend a lot of time making sure that we know what's good as well. You know, you have to know the good and the bad to get the whole picture. So yeah, absolutely. We look at both.
Jim, another thing you've noticed is that these days malware campaigns are being run by, total amateurs. And, we've seen malware authors and distributors offer their stuff as a service in the past, but now it's like super turnkey, like grandpa could run a malware campaign these days, right?
Something that continues to kind of, shock people and surprise them is, how much easier things have gotten from an attack standpoint for attackers with little to no skill. Several years ago, we started to see this kind of shift in sort of the as a service world of malware and ransomware, especially. But it's really gotten to a point now where pretty much every day a new service pops up where anybody with like little to no coding skill can generate some pretty dangerous malware of various types, including ransomware, and also have mechanisms in place to distribute it, while also removing themselves from direct risk. So there's, pretty easy to use and get to distribution systems or spreaders. And it's, at the end of the day, it's very easy for people who have zero experience in writing anything, let alone malware, to launch some pretty powerful attacks. So that's something that kind of keeps people awake at night and is always kind of an ooh-ah eye-opener. When you talk about, especially some of the ransomware as a service stuff has like been popping up in the last year.
Well, it seems interesting, right? Because of the way that it's turned into this business that's more or less gone from, people who might know each other already collaborating in the business to now right. Anyone can just go and sign up for these services. The end attacker, the person who's actually going to be using the malware to try to generate the revenue, I mean, their job just becomes risk mitigation and OPSEC at that point, right? So it's like
absolutely
everyone's getting hyper specialized, right?
Well, yeah. Especially when you mentioned the risk management side of things. It's attractive for the people at the highest level to remove themselves as much as possible from the direct risk. And so, out of that, there's sort of a whole economy of like middlemen and mules, if you will, to just kind of handle some of the, not just hands-on keyboard stuff, but the basic administrative tasks of dealing with or building pieces of malware, popping servers to install them. But at the same time, the largest cut is still going up the top because they're the ones that are finding these resources and seeding them with the initial installers or pieces that are relevant to the campaign to do the attack. You see that really loud and clear with stuff like a Pony Loader, where you always have a small group or a guy or two at the top, but then there's this huge sort of pool of people that are responsible for taking the install archives, putting them on the POP servers, and then doing the daily logins and making sure that they're not at least the campaign's not traceable to the top. You'll see them screw up a lot OPSEC wise to where they kind of reveal where they're logging in from and that kind of stuff. But most of the people that are quote managing like pony botnets are not the people that wrote it or designed the server for that campaign. It's all at least one or two steps removed at that point.
So would you say really we've got three classes of people in this type of attack? We've got the tool developer, we've got the tool distributor, and then we've got the operator.
In a lot of cases, yeah, that's absolutely true.
Is that typical though, or is it more likely that the distributor will double down as the operator?
you know, it kind of scales. So with the larger, more, you know, sophisticated is not the right word, but voluminous attacks, you will see more of that separation. But with some of the, you know, smaller kind of one-offs, all the way down to where you just have kind of a guy that grabs something off a forum and wants to see if he can, you know, improve his skill or figure out how this tool works. So he's going to, you know, do the building, do the compiling, whatever, and then also be the one to weaponize and deliver. You know, it goes down to that level. But kind of the larger you get and the more, you know, focused you get on a longer duration attack, the more you start to see the separation of duties.
Yeah, I'm wondering how that evolved though, right? Because I'm thinking if I can understand a bit of a separation between between development and distribution. I get that because they require different skill sets, but I'm sort of surprised that there's a separation between between distributors and operators. But I guess this is the retail malware game. I'm just wondering, as a distributor, why on earth I would allow some amateur operator to kind of use my distribution network when it's probably going to cause trouble for me when they get arrested.
Well, if they can trace it back to you, yeah. You know, a lot of times, you know, just like in some other avenues of crime, you know, just because the author of a tool hands something to the distributor, that doesn't mean the distributor necessarily knows who the real author is. You know, you can cover your tracks and obfuscate yourself so that, you know, here's my tool that you are to weaponize and deliver. Here is your payment. Now go do the thing that you have agreed to do for that payment. And all that stuff can be, you know, obfuscated to a point where, you know, even the distributor doesn't really know how to be traced back or trace via himself back to the author.
All righty. Well, a complete reshuffle in the way people are doing malware, and also a bit of a look at the... I'm just so glad to have someone on the show who also hates the term fireless malware. Jim Walter, hey. Thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat through all this stuff.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
That was Jim Walter of Cylance there. Big thanks to him for that. Go check out Cylance at cylance.com, cylance.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.